Satan, like, he is always at work. He's always trying to get us. And I think two of his favorite lies are that we're worse than we are or better than we are.
We are women encouraging and equipping women to universally and uniquely serve Christ in their feminine vocation.
By embracing joy, laughter, freedom, and friendship, we are seeking to thrive in the trenches of our domestic churches. Oh, oh, oh.
Welcome to Thriving in the Trenches podcast. This is Becky Carter.
And this is Megan Schreiber. You're listening to episode 28. Today, we will be discussing the feminine body image. Well, I am super excited today for our guest. We have Emily Stimson Chapman joining us. Emily is a Catholic author penning many books. Some of them you may know, The Catholic Girl's Survival Guide for the Single Years, These Beautiful Bones, An Everyday Theology of the Body, and her latest book titled The Catholic Table, Finding Joy Where Food and Faith Meet. Emily is a contributing editor at Our Sunday Visitor, and her writings have appeared in First Things, the National Catholic Register, and Catholic Digest. Emily, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
Hi, Emily. Welcome. Thank you so much for being here. So today we're going to kind of hone in on the feminine body image. But first, we'd love for you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, no, I grew up Catholic, but I always say I was catechized in the 1980s. So that means I wasn't really catechized at all. Not a lot of good catechesis happening in that decade, unless your parents were theologians, which mine were not. So I left the church when I was 19. I was a sophomore in college, and I met a really cute Protestant boy. And I've mentioned to this before, but I always say that cute Protestant boys and bad catechesis are a very dangerous combination. So I was way more interested in pleasing the boy when he was putting questions to me about Jesus and truth and the church than I was in actually finding answers to the questions he was putting to me. So I left the church, which ended up being a blessing in a lot of ways. It was with him and the friends I met that I really got to know who Jesus Christ was and gave my life to Jesus. And just learned what it meant to have a relationship with Christ. So I was intentionally discipled, you know, is the buzzword these days, in a very fruitful way. So that 6 years later, when I met a very smart Catholic coworker who put those same questions to me, by that point I was interested in finding the answers, and I knew Jesus was real. I just needed to figure out this church question. So I came back to the church then, and it has been a beautiful journey. So I'm newly married now. I think after 13 months, you can still say newly married, living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in a big old house that my husband and I have been restoring from top to bottom and, you know, trying not to become an alcoholic in the process. So, that's where we are.
That's awesome. I think you can say newly married. I think we should be saying newly married for a long time because it sounds good.
Right. It's fun. It's definitely the time to restore a house because you're in that honeymoon stage. It's like, yes, honey, whatever you want, honey. Oh, honey, I don't want to upset you. It's a great time if you're going to, you know, completely gut a house from top to bottom to do it.
That's true. That's a very good point.
Awesome.
That's so great. Well, I just am so excited to have you on. You are a prolific writer. You have so many great intellectual reads too. Not only they are fun and joyful about, you know, food and girls' survival guide, but I think they're really rich and deep. And so I thank you for your witness in that. We did indicate that we were going to be talking about the feminine body image. And a lot of what Becky and I prayed about in connecting with you and coming up with this topic is that what we really like to do in Thriving in the Trenches is talk about topics that are difficult to talk about, but also maybe aren't being talked about at all, which leads a lot of women to feel oftentimes isolated and misunderstood too. So, you know, part of your journey is that you also experience some, you know, a heavy cross with a body image. And I don't know if you're comfortable kind of going right in and speaking to that at all, but we would love to have some of your journey and insight on that topic.
Oh, yeah. I wrote a whole book about it. So yeah. I kind of have to be comfortable talking about it.
Right.
No, when I was actually not long before I met that cute Protestant boy, I had a crush on another boy. I had, you know, as a typical freshman, I did what typical freshmen do. I ate a lot of pizza. I drank a lot of bad beer. I gained the freshman 15 and then some. And I was not happy with it, but I also wasn't thinking I needed to do something drastic until a boy that I had a crush on made a comment about my weight gain. Mm. And the next day, in typical choleric, disciplined fashion, I started dieting. And I'm not just talking like, oh, I'm going to give up gluten. I gave up everything. I gave up cheeseburgers and pizza and chocolate and bread and everything good in life. And for the better part of the next 6 years, I subsisted on iceberg lettuce and tuna and Mrs. Dash. It is not a diet I recommend. You're not going to find it that recipe in any cookbook. I was a hangry, crabby, you know, lost little soul for a long time there. But it worked. And I lost 15 pounds and then another 10 and another 10. And by the time I was a senior in college, I was 50 pounds thinner than I was when I was a freshman. I did not have 50 pounds to lose. So I did not look my best at the time, even though I thought I looked pretty good. So by the time I was a senior in college, I was starting to really understand what was going on with the eating disorder. What were some of the root issues? I realized it was wrong. You know, I didn't know a lot of theology at the time, but I knew enough to know that God had made my body and he probably did not appreciate me starving it to death. But I didn't really know how to stop. So I would try, I would eat a little bit more, exercise a little bit less, but that would either end with me panicking and feeling like I had to stop eating entirely, or I just wouldn't be able to stop. And I would binge and then find some way to purge, usually by overexercising. So that went on until I was 25 and I came back into the Catholic Church. And it was there that in my encounter with the Eucharist and with John Paul II's theology of the body, that I found not only healing, but complete healing, a complete new way of seeing my body, of seeing food, of seeing the world. And that has made all the difference over the past 17 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, that's that's quite a story, but I think so many women are going to relate to that. I know that I can relate to that. I can remember being in eighth grade and a boy who was sitting across from me at the lunch table made a comment about me being fat. And I've always been very athletic, so I've never been the skinny girl. Just never have. It's just not in my body, DNA. And so anyway, it threw me for a tailspin. And so I struggled with bulimia all during high school and actually up until the point that I met my husband and had a conversion myself, realizing that, oh, I can't treat my body this way. This is not how God would ask me to treat his temple. So, but I would say that the body image portion of it is still so difficult, especially in this culture. So I'd love to hear how you, or what it was exactly that really flipped a switch for you and started you down that path of recovery and complete healing, as you say.
It really was twofold. They go hand in hand because body image and food, it's all wrapped up together. So the first part of it was just coming to have a profound understanding of what the Eucharist was. You know, when I first came back into the church, I knew the doctrine. I knew the Eucharist was the body and blood of Christ, but I didn't see it as this radical gift of self, this radical act of love. And I certainly didn't make the connection between the food I was struggling with every day and the food that was God himself in the Eucharist until one day I was on my way back from Mass and a thought ran through my mind, and that thought was, the most intimate encounter I have with God is that I eat him. You know, he becomes food for me. And the more I meditated on that and the more I thought about it, started to seeing how all food is this sacramental symbol of the Eucharist. It helps us understand what the Eucharist is doing in the world. It's a symbol of what God is doing on the altar. And that made me realize, okay, I cannot abuse this great gift of God. Like, I need to appreciate it. I need to be grateful for it. I need to enjoy it. God did not make bacon taste so good so that I could not eat it. You know, if God didn't want me, you know, if he didn't want us eating bacon, he would have made it taste like beets. So I needed to appreciate that. But then another really important moment for me was I had been reading John Paul II's Theology of the Body and meditating on it and thinking about, you know, just how different my understanding of the body was, because I saw the body as it was this thing separate from myself. It was this thing I needed to control. I needed to mold it. I needed to shape it. I needed to make it what it should be so that it would be attractive. It was sort of like a carrying case for an iPhone, or you know, it was a husk. It was this thing exterior to myself. But reading John Paul II's Theology of the Body, I started saying, no, my body is me. Like, my body is what makes my soul visible to the world. My body is what makes it possible for me to love people and serve God. And it's this wonderful part of me. It is a temple. It is the image of God. And I was at the gym one morning, and I've been thinking through these thoughts. And, you know, there's always a difference between when you're thinking thoughts and reading them in a book and when you actually feel them and connect them with your life. And I was at the gym doing some exercise I hated. I have no, probably lifting weights. I think that's what I was doing. I was looking in the, and all I wanted to do was go to the showers. I had already taught a fitness class that morning. I still had a full day of work ahead of me. I did not want to be lifting weights, but I was sitting there sort of cheering or really badgering myself on, being like, you have to control your body. You've got to control this. And suddenly another voice spoke inside my head and said, no, you have to care for it. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there was this radical shift where I saw, like, oh, you know, our faith calls me to care for my body like it's a temple. It doesn't call me to control it. Controlling, you control a problem, right? Like, when there's a problem, you've got to control it. You've got to exercise power over it. The body isn't a problem. The body is a gift, and you care for gifts. You cherish gifts. And so that started shifting my thinking about how I was supposed to act. What does it mean to care for the body? You know, I want to make sure I have energy. I want to make sure that I'm healthy. I want to be able to do these things God is calling me to do. I want to be able to love the people God is calling me to love. So I have to exercise. I have to eat right. But I don't have to beat my body into submission. I don't have to sculpt it and shape it and, you know, have a BMI of under 19. That's not caring for your body. And so we live in a culture where women are continually told that our bodies are not good enough. You can weigh 105 and not think your body is good enough because your hip bones stick out too much or your breasts aren't the right size. Like, there is no perfect body. We're all chasing after this elusive perfect body. So it's not that moving around in this world, I don't have days where I'm like, it sure would be nice to have thinner thighs. You know, that would be a great thing if I didn't have to worry about that. But there's emotional Emily and there's rational Emily. And rational Emily always goes back to, well, if you wanted to have thighs, you know, the size that you think would be perfect, you would no longer be able to eat chocolate and bacon, and you would be crabby and angry, and nobody would want to be around you. And does that make any sense? No, doesn't make any sense. So I always go back to the caring. All right, what does my body need right now that I'm caring for it and giving it all of the energy and exercise and sleep that it needs to do what I'm supposed to do what God is calling me to do.
That is great. You know, I'm listening to both of you, and I'm hearing, you know, a similarity in the story, and I'm thinking about how at a young age, I mean, Becky, you were really young, that a lie was planted, you know, and it, and the subtlety of that lie and how pervasive that can grow and how quickly, almost like a wildfire, you know, and it was a negative lie about your body. I would say that there's also a second piece of that, and that's a bit of where I come in, which is interesting that the three of us are having this conversation, and that is a different lie, And that was the over-complimentarity of my body by guys, right? So it became this means of hypersexualization for me, right? That, okay, my body is good and it's attractive and they tell me all the time. So now I have an expectation to live up to, right? It didn't, and I didn't, praise God, suffer to the level that you two have, but I obsessed, right? You know, I obsessed and placed value on my worth based on, was I keeping up that really, you know, sexual image that's pleasing to men? Like, that's another lie, but it's just completely on the other extreme. Like, I didn't hate my body. I loved my body, but I loved it to an excess. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes total sense. Yeah, you know, I think you're right, because Satan, like, he is always at work. He's always trying to get us. And I think two of his favorite lies are that we're worse than we are or better than we are. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants us to either just wallow in our imperfections and our sin and not see the things that actually make us valuable and lovable in God's eyes. Or he wants us to think that we are so great and so good and so important that we don't need Jesus, you know, and we just can put our worth in a different basket. So there's always those two lies. And it, for us, we each of us has to identify what lie is Satan telling me in this moment.
Right.
Because, yeah, some people don't need to hear, you're beautiful, your body is valuable. They need to hear, okay, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And it's funny. I mean, through my whole journey, too, and it was a huge journey that, you know, I can remember, you know, having children, which is, you know, obviously the just such an amazing part of my life. With my first, though, I was afraid not to care for a child. I was afraid what that was going to mean to this really great body, right? So it was just this complete selfish lens that I was living in. And how was I going to sacrifice that up for this other being? But the beauty of how God works, as always, is like that was a pivotal point for me, was recognizing not my body for how it can please others and how it can be a picture shining outward. It was what it is capable of doing in its highest feminine role. And it blew me away. It blew me away that my body could carry this child, could nurse this child. And that was a real healing point for me, which was amazing. And then it's funny, the second deeper healing point for me also was theology of the body. And there, I think Emily, you literally picked up John Paul's writing and read it. I tried that. I got through a page and I realized I needed somebody else to kind of really bring it down to my level. And so I'm thankful for places like the Theology of the Body Institute and Christopher West and what they're doing, because it was, I could just grasp it a little bit better. And there's a line in there that, you know, my instructor kind of said and then just continued, but it stopped me dead in my tracks. And that was, you know, our body makes visible the invisible. Now, somebody might say, well, yeah, and then just keep moving. But to your point about our body being a carrying case or, you know, a husk on a corn, that was it. Like, wait, there's so much weight. Like, to really think about that our body is making visible the invisible was like, just blew my head off, you know, like, oh my gosh. And to recognize the holiness of our body, right? The capability of our femininity was just amazing. It was just amazing. And so I love that you're pointing out, Emily, too, that we need to kind of understand what lie has been planted and why and how we're responding to that lie that's not in line with the image that God has for us as his daughters.
There is a truth that keeps on coming through the years. So when I was 25, I needed to see something about my body that I was not being given by the culture. And the theology of the body gave that to me. You know, now my husband and I are struggling with infertility. We, you know, desperately want to be able to conceive a baby, and the doctors can't come up with any reason why I'm not, because all my numbers are great, but it's just not happening. And so there's this new struggle with my body, whereas you were talking about, you know, these amazing things your body can do. And I'm like, what the holy heck is wrong with you, body? Like, why aren't you doing what you're supposed to be doing? This is what you were made for. This is what other women's bodies do, like when they're sleeping. My friends look at their husbands and they get pregnant. And my body is just, doesn't matter how perfect the numbers are, everything's great, it's not happening. And so I'm like, okay, I have to learn to see that my body is still capable of mothering people in a different way. It's still capable of loving people in a different way. It is still a woman's body, even though it can't, or at least not so far, can't do this thing that women's bodies are supposed to do. And the theology of the body helps me to continually see that, whereas if I were just focused on what every other woman's body around me was doing, I would be a lot more frustrated than I am. And I'm already pretty frustrated. So right. Thank God for the theology of the body on that one.
That's true. Absolutely. But yeah. I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's all, you know, another topic that is a heavy, you know, burden for women to say that, yes, this is what my body is made for, and why is it not working in that way? So many times think about the profound impact that theology of the body has had on me and my life and my marriage. And, you know, a lot of people are still like, isn't that just about sex? And I'm like, no,
no. Emily Stimson Chapman's book.
Exactly. Because it's like, honestly, it changed my lens of how I viewed my mom, my sisters, my friends. It was a writing and a teaching that was so desperately needed in our church when it was given, but even more so now.
No, it has so much to say. It has things to say about eating. My whole understanding of food has been shaped by the theology of the body. It has things to say about friendship, about work, about prayer, about how you dress. I think it has things to say about how you decorate your house. You know, this whole renovation we're doing of our house, I've got the theology of the body in mind as I'm, you know, making decisions and going ahead with different plans. So the theology of the body really is, it's just the sacramental worldview. It's seeing the world with Catholic eyes, and right action follows from right vision. Like, you can't act right if you don't see right, if you're not living in reality, if you don't see what your body is, if you don't see what the world in front of you is, you can't treat it right. You can't think about it right. So that's why the theology of the body is so helpful, because our world gives us a wrong vision of the body. It gives us a wrong vision of motherhood. It gives us a wrong vision of just about everything. So we need to find that corrector. And I think the theology of the body does a powerful job with that.
Amen.
I will, when you said care for your body, not control it. Wow. That one. It was like you just yelled it. You really didn't yell it, but that really spoke to me very loudly and very clearly. And as you bring up the infertility, our fertility seems to have, it's not there. I guess this is what you consider secondary infertility, mm-hmm. which is really weird, because, you know, struggling with secondary infertility is very weird, because I, like the woman your friends that you described, would look at your husband or would look at their husbands and get pregnant. That was our married life. And for certain reasons, those things have changed. And so I had to go through that grieving process. I had to see what it was like to be infertile, to say, wait, oh, you mean that just because, you know, 1 + 1 isn't equaling 2, you know, and just because I was expecting our bodies to do something, my body wasn't doing it. And so, okay, well, do I need to take more B vitamins? Do I need to do this? Do I need to do that? I'm trying to control my body rather than just letting go and living out my vocation as it is now. And letting the other stuff, let the Lord control it. I'm caring for my body. I'm eating well. I'm enjoying the food. I'm enjoying the wine that the Lord has given us. I need to care for my body, not control it. That was really big. I'm glad you said it exactly that way, Emily.
Yeah, and I need to remember a little bit of my own advice when it comes to the fertility thing. I'm very good about it, letting go with the weight, but I was joking with somebody that, you know, the cost of vitamins right now, you know, trying to get pregnant in your early 40s. I'm like, it's a line item in the budget. You know, I gotta make sure I sell extra books to cover the vitamins. But we have this idea that our modernist culture has given us that we can just fix everything if we take the right amount of vitamins, if we have the Napro surgery, if we, I don't know, block out the sun from your room and eat enough bee pollen and, you know, just give up everything good in life and eat nothing but lettuce, that we can make our bodies do what they're supposed to do. And it just doesn't work like that. So that leads to a lot of the frustration, because you feel like, oh, I'm doing all of these scientific things and people stop telling me to do them because I'm already doing them. So it really does. I have to learn to die to myself more and apply that wisdom to how I'm approaching this whole infertility journey. And there's not a lot of discussion in the church about infertility. There's not a lot of discussion about singleness and women who are aging and not able to get married and conceive children. So these are all topics I think that the theology of the body can speak to in real powerful ways. And we just have to get it to those people, get it to those audiences, get it to the people even sometimes who write the books about it. You have to remind yourself about what you wrote.
Right. Right. And, you know, it also calls for us being gentle with ourselves, right? Because that's, you know, to that point, Becky, that jumped out at me too, caring and not controlling. Like all of us, you know, whether we're physical mothers or spiritual mothers or daughters, if we had to care for somebody else's body, whether it's an aging parent or a young child, we would never try to control their bodies, ever. That would be complete. That would seem really disordered. We want to care for them. What do you need? How can I help you? What, you know, how can I make you comfortable? Do I need to bathe you? And, you know, even in my case, when my mom was in hospice, like what a gift that was for me to be able to bathe my mom. We have to do that for ourselves. I think women are amazing at being receptive, also giving out to others, but we are really good at not giving that same grace to ourselves, that same gentleness and that same care for ourselves. And maybe I'm just talking about me. Maybe I'm really just talking about me. But I do see that. I see that with my friends too. You know, I say, oh gosh, you know, give yourself permission to be gentle with yourself in that situation. Right. Yeah.
That's such wisdom.
We would all benefit to treat ourselves a little bit more tenderly.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about partying.
Another one of my favorite topics.
That's great.
We got lots of wine and booze here, remember? We got the renovation going on.
Exactly. So. Right?
I can host it.
Okay, well, we're going to come to your house. You know, Megan's not far from you. She's in Philadelphia. Now, I'm in Arkansas, so I have a little bit of a trek to go. But I've read your blog, The Catholic Table, which is... it goes along with your new book, The Catholic Table. And I love the way you speak to your home and your food being a very theology of the body way of loving on others. And the beauty of wine, the beauty of good food. And I'm telling you, you're in my kitchen a lot more than it might make you feel a little uncomfortable how much I think about some of the words that you've written through the years about food, about the feasting, about the celebration, and just what a gift that is. And the feasting and the fasting and the liturgical year, you know, I just think it's such a great gift. And you do a really beautiful job of bringing the beauty to your readers.
Oh, thank you. You know, one of the things that my husband and I made a commitment to when we got married was hospitality. Like, thank God I married a man who does not mind house guests and large parties. I don't know if we could have gotten married if he did it. But for me, it has always been a way, and I know this is going to sound strange, of being open to life. So I think we are all called to be open to life, and that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, because if you're single, you can't you shouldn't probably be having a baby at that point in time. But that doesn't mean that you're not welcoming life into your home. It doesn't mean that you're not creating the conditions where people can feel loved and accepted and nurtured and fed. And now, as we're married, it's even more important for us, since we're not currently having children, to be still bringing people into our home and really creating a culture of life within these walls. So food is so important to doing that. People need to be fed. You know, food is always reminding us that we need community, that we need to be nurtured, that we need to be comforted, that we need, you know, to depend on one another. And it also reminds us, you know, that we need to be thinking about God, who is the one who always feeds us with his grace. So having a home where there is an ample amount of food and there's plenty of wine and just the conditions for people to feel loved and welcome is a way that we all can be, you know, open to life. That's really, in a way, what hospitality is. It's an openness to the other. It's a welcoming of the other. It's inviting the other in and loving them at wherever they are.
Oh, I love that. Open to life. Oh, that's great, because we really do have parties here all the time.
Yeah, it's just very Catholic. It's a very Catholic thing to do, right? Catholics are open to life. So we have parties. We have good parties, because we're looking at our parties.
Oh, we do.
Exactly. And what a great way to be a joyful witness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, so sometimes I get a little crabby just before the party. Maybe a little.
Oh, I do too.
If you come afterwards, if you come, like, make sure you come on time and not early, and I will be a totally joyful witness. But if you show up 15 minutes early, you might not get that.
You know what's funny, Emily? I'm the same way, and I'll tell you why I am. Because I want everything perfect, and I'm doing one last wipe of the counter or something. And I've had a couple of my kids say to me, like, "Mom, are you sure you really like doing this? Because you seem pretty angry right now." And I was like, "You're right. Like, leave it to the kids to point it out." And I was like, "No, I really do like this." And they're like, "Mom, no one's going to notice that fingerprint that you just saw. We don't even see it." So the beauty of the children too, and their teens and stuff, is to just to be like, "Relax, Mom. It's all good. It's true. I have to, you know, sometimes I just get a little too worked up and wanting to have everything just right." You know.
My problem is always I want to enjoy the company. Like, I don't want to be trapped to the stove. I want to have things at a certain point so I can just relax and enjoy everybody. But that inevitably means that I'm somewhat a crazy, like, Tasmanian devil in the time before everybody shows up. I'm like, "Don't show up when I'm the Tasmanian devil. I'll be calm by the time you get here." So
it's funny. So funny. And you can bet that you've been pre-gaming, right, while you're cooking?
Oh, yes. Yes, my husband is so good. He has learned fast. 13 months, this man knows what to do. He'll see me in a certain mood. He's like, "I'm going to go put the glass for the martini in the fridge right now." He is an expert martini maker. Yeah, so that's his primary job as I'm getting ready for a dinner party. Make sure there is a glass of something in front of my wife.
That's great. That's great.
Man, that is a good man.
He is a good man. He's so good.
Totally. You waited all that time for that.
Yes,
worth,
I know.
Worth the wait.
He was super worth it. Yes.
That's so great. I think that's a great encouragement to our single listeners too. And I love the, I have not read, but I love the title of your book, The Catholic Girl's Survival Guide for the Single Years. I wish I had that when I was single. I would have saved myself a lot of tears and poor decision-making.
Well, that's one of the reasons, you know, I did not want to write that book. I got bamboozled into that by editors, because what 35-year-old woman wants to write a book about being single? I mean, who wants to be single so long that you're considered the expert on the topic by anybody? Not me. So I got my arm twisted, and then I felt like God was hounding me and quartering me, and I agreed to do it. But it's actually, it's super fun. This weekend I was speaking in Mobile, Alabama, and I was signing, some girls were buying that book, and I was getting to sign it with my married name. And I was like, "Oh, this makes it all worth it. That's just great." But no, it was a blessing for me, because, as I said, there's the emotional Emily and there's the saner Emily. So when you write the best version of your thoughts down on paper, you can go back to them and remind yourself of, "Oh yeah, that's smart. You got to do that. You told people to do that. Do that." So it was helpful for me in that respect. But I also have gotten to meet so many women who are really trying to live the church's teachings and longing to be a wife and mother, but trying to be joyful witnesses. And they need some companionship and support as they do that. And so I love that my book has been able to be that friend for them when they're struggling and they feel like everyone else around them is getting married and having babies.
Absolutely. That's one thing in our podcast when we, Megan and I, were kind of forming our vision and letting the Lord really lead us, which he has done very, very clearly. And one thing that was very important and on our hearts was that this was not a podcast for married women, for moms. And every time someone says that, so how's that podcast going? So for moms, blah, blah, blah. No, it is not for moms. No, we are women. And that's why we talk about the uniqueness and the universality of our feminine vocations. It's not married. It's not mom. It's not single. It's all of it. We're feminine. And there's a genius behind it. And that's what we want to plug into. So we really strive to have our topics to be generalized on the most part. Some are more, you know, specific, but we want them to be general enough that someone who is a divorced mom, a single mom, or not a mom, you know, that we can all, or someone seeking the religious life, that all can be encouraged and become better women, whatever vocation they're what current, you know, stage of life they're in.
Now, and it's so important because we're not meant to be isolated into our very specific demographic groups. So all the married women with 5 kids hang out in one corner, and the married women with 1 child in one corner, and then the married woman with no kids there, and then the single woman there. That's not how it's supposed to be. That's not how communities have worked for thousands of years. There's so much to be gained from each other's friendship and companionship and wisdom. I mean, when I was 25, 30 years old, watching my friends having babies and seeing the amazing things their bodies could do, that gave me new respect for my body. I have learned I can converse, whatever, you pick the topic, this like homeschooling, breastfeeding, episiotomies, like I can talk about it all, okay? I've been there with friends through 6 different births. Like I have got this wealth of knowledge I never would have had if I had been shut out of my friends' conversations. And they always get me with 2 hands and no kids to occupy them. So when I was single, I would go and take care of my best friend's kids while they were recovering from C-sections or the birth of their baby. And I would cook for them and I would, you know, do all the things that needed to be done. If friends just need me to go to the zoo with them, I can go. Like, there's so much that we can gain from each other's friendship. And I think one of the ways that the devil really seeks to divide Catholic and Christian communities is by, you know, telling the married women who are at home with the kids, like, yet that woman who's single, she's got it all together. She's going to judge you. She's going to judge your house. She's working. Like, just don't talk to her. And they tell single, you know, he tells single women different lies. So it's really recognizing how much we have to give each other and learn from each other and help each other. And there's such a richness in that. So I really admire you guys for doing that with the podcast.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah. That's really nice. No, I think I'm really glad that you said that. And I kind of put that as a cautionary tale out for others, all of our listeners, because I think we do that. And I think the problem when we do that is we also silo people's problems, right? You know, the married person might be walking around thinking, well, I know I really connected with that young single gal at church. She's nice, but she'd never understand because she doesn't have this problem, right? And so then we can tend to insulate ourselves because we silo problems, because we silo mm-hmm. people, we silo demographics. That's also an encouragement that I have for our listeners, is to be more open to ministering to our femininity and our female companions, no matter where they are, what stage they're in.
Emily, this was an absolute joy. Thank you so much for sharing your time, sharing your heart with us, your story. You are a blessing. So thank you for putting your voice out there for all of us.
Oh, it was so great to talk to you guys. I wish that it could have been in person over coffee or a glass of wine or something, but we'll have to correct that at some point and get y'all here. We've got rooms for both of you.
That sounds well, great. I'm driving.
Let's do it.
Thanks so much, Emily.
It was great talking to you guys.
Wow, Becky, Emily was awesome. I mean, she has so much to contribute, and what a great witness to the feminine vocation of being a Catholic woman.
Yeah, absolutely. Her writings have really blessed me over the years, and I'm just super thankful that she's willing to be open and honest and share her struggles with us and just be real. I mean, if you don't read her blog, I hope our listeners will pick up that blog and start reading it, especially as she's doing her renovation. I did get tickled. One of her blog posts was titled Day Drinking in the Rubble. So she's definitely a girl after my own heart.
And her blog is The Catholic Table, correct? Is in the same title as the book?
It is. Great. It is. So she has a new book, The Catholic Table, and it is based off of her blog, thecatholictable.com. So
we'll have that in show notes.
I will put all that in the show notes. She's got great resources. Her book, These Beautiful Bones, was my first exposure to her writings, and it's just everyday theology of the body, basically. It's not, I mean, she was single when she wrote it, so this is not told from a married woman's point of view. It's really for everyone. And I love her explanation of where even the title of the book came from. But you have to read the book to know where it came from. Mm-hmm.
So. That's great. Well, as we move into our follow-up, we should have a Bible verse. I think you have one handy.
So we're going to move on to John 6, of course, if we are going to be speaking of the Eucharist and how transforming it is. And that was really one of those conversion points for and healing points for Emily in her journey with her eating disorder. And so we're going to move to John 6, which is the Bread of Life discourse. And Jesus is giving the disciples many hard words, and they even say in John 60, they say, this is a hard saying. Who can listen to it? In John 6:50, this is the bread which comes down from heaven, that a man may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread which I give for the life of the world is my flesh. And then, of course, the Jews were like, why does he say we can eat his flesh? That was very much against the Judaic law. So Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. And I just think of, you know, Emily having this great conversion just after receiving the Eucharist, which we believe is the summit of our faith. We become one with Christ, full of his grace flowing through our bodies. And I just pictured, and she was saying that, I just pictured God's grace flowing through our body with the healing power of his love and his mercy.
Becky, that's great. I think that's a passage that we need to reflect on and always remember that it is the source and summit of our faith, the Eucharist, and really receive Jesus with such reverence, you know, whenever we are able, which is such a gift. You know, you think of people who can't. I know when our daughter was doing missionary work in Ecuador, I mean, a priest might come to that village once a month. You know,
right.
And you know, we're so blessed to have that intimate encounter with Christ available to us daily. So I think that's so great. And you know, that leads us into our call to action. And again, taking from Emily's story, the call to action I'd like to propose is that as women, we take more care for our body as opposed to control over our body. And if it's not just our body, what other situation in our trench, in our home life, in our family life, in our single life, do we try to control instead of care for?
Mm-hmm. What you even mentioned, even if we are moms and controlling our children instead of caring for them, you've mentioned that before.
Right. I really appreciated her just taking those two, you know, action verbs and planning those, because it is that motion that brings us to a different place. And it's also a bit of freedom to be able to give of ourselves in caring for, as opposed to trying to control.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking the exact same thing. It kind of harkened me back to our Freedom podcast, especially with Gloria talking about that freedom that we have when we are living in God's plan rather than our own plan. And when you're trying to control a situation, you're definitely not seeking God and God's plan.
That's right. That's right. Which yeah. then also leads us into our saint quote. Which
yes.
we had to go with St. John Paul II, since we talked so much about theology of the body, and he's just loaded with excellent advice.
Absolutely. So, you know, I know as women, when we are struggling with our value as women, unfortunately, we allow the culture to seep in and the lies of the evil one seep in and tell us who we are, because our value is based on our body size or how strong we are, how much we can lift or whatever. And so we picked St. John Paul II's quote, "We are not the sum of our weaknesses and failures. We are the sum of the Father's love for us and our real capacity to become the image of his Son." What else is there?
You know? That's right. What else is there? And to rest in the love of the Father, to become like Jesus. That's what we're called to.
Yeah.
And those two go together. Some mm-hmm. people don't want to rest in the love of the Father, or they reject it on the search just for Jesus. But as he said, no one can come to the Father except through me. So those things have to be together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, good. Well, guys, thank you for joining us this week. We're so thankful for all of you with us in the trenches. You can find show notes on thrivinginthetrenches.com. Please subscribe. Leave us a review on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where you can join the conversation. Thanks for coming.